Hey, it's Steve Imke. In the fall of 2016, I had an opportunity to spend two nights with a class full of hobbyists that wanted to learn how to take a hobby that they love and turn it into a viable business. During those two nights, I took them on a journey of business entrepreneurship. I'm sorry you didn't make it, and I hope this is the next best thing. Here are excerpts from that live event. Hope you enjoy it. But even more important, I hope it inspires you to get off the couch and do something with it. Thanks for listening. So this is what we're going to be talking about today. We'll have a little bit of an overview. We'll talk about some facts, myths, and challenges that are typically associated with any type of business for that matter. We'll talk about financial thresholds. We'll talk about marketing thresholds, planning, some traditional and lean planning processes, some strategies and tactics, and then we'll talk a little bit about funding as we kind of go through there. So let's talk a little bit about some business facts here. Here's one of the things I always think about it, and that is I can make numbers tell you whatever I want them to tell you. But it would be almost malpractice on my side to tell you that all of you are going to be successful. And in spite of everything that we'll talk about here and all the resources that you have here at your disposal, it's quite frankly, it's statistically, there's a lot of different problems. So with what I really wanted to kind of focus on is, first off, is the size of what small business really is. And, you know, I'll be honest with you, I'm not 100% sure I like the word small business. And I'll tell you why. It's because on a couple occasions I've had opportunity to go to Washington, D.C. and lobby for small businesses on behalf of Colorado Springs. And when I go there, I had an opportunity to hobnob with congressmen and senators. And so I sit there in a cocktail party and I'll say, please define to me, you know, give me your definition of small business. And pretty much this is the response I get. 250 employees. Been in business for 10 years and has stellar credit. And now, I tell you what, I have literally counseled thousands and thousands of small businesses, and none of them would meet that qualification, okay? Well, I mean, because most of them are starting out. Now, they haven't been in business for 10 years, so that's pretty much a disqualification. So, but here's some of the statistics that we have. Quite literally, almost 80% of all businesses are what we call non-employer businesses. These are side hustles that people have out there. These are what we call lifestyle businesses, generally under $1 million, so a couple employees or something like that. When we talk about non-employers, what we're really talking about here is the owners are the only workers in the business. There's really technically no employees in there. Everybody takes a share of profit as opposed to a salary, which has, you know, it's a kind of a fixed cost. But if you take a look at it statistically, I mean, it literally 99.7% of all businesses are small businesses by that definition, because there's so many of them. I read an interesting statistic here, though, recently, and I didn't have a chance to get it into the slides, but and that is 35% of all working people have a side hustle somewhere along the line, whether that's a lawn care business, maybe where they do, you know, do stuff on the side, or you know, like my visible fencing story. I mean, I was working for a company and I was still doing that. Now I had employees, we call them contractors, because I'd bring them in for the job, kind of a thing, and then let them go afterwards. But quite frankly, that was my side hustle to go off and do that. So that's a huge part of the population out there. They create 64% of all new jobs. Almost 50% of employment is in the small business space. You know, and then you got the Walmarts. They take up the big, but that counts as one, statistically. You know, and so does that part-time invisible fencing business. You know what I'm saying? That counts as one. So it's always sometimes nice to be compared to Walmart, I guess. Huh? And see, you can see there's in the case here, almost 30 million small businesses that are out there when I pulled up these statistics right here, and 52%, over half of them, are what we call home-based, which is kind of where we're kind of our sweet spot here. Now, with respect to survival rates, they tend to go down over time. Now, again, statistically, I can tell you. So I like to tell a story of, I used to have a fix and flip business. And so the typical scenario with a fix and flip business was you buy a house, you create a limited liability company. Generally, the name of the limited liability company is the address of the house. You invest some money into it. You hire some contractors. They do a bunch of work on the property. Ultimately, you sell the property. And guess what happens? A year later, what happens to that business? You don't keep that limited liability. You let it dissolve. And if you have another house, you start another one, kind of a thing. And so statistically, that factors in here. That's a business that essentially from, you know, from their statistics, the way they compiled that, is a failed business because it didn't renew its registration. So again, like I told you, we can make numbers tell you whatever you want. But there is a list of things that are typically failure related. And here's some of them. Lack of capital, lack of planning, poor management, cash flow and stuff. But I'll tell you, there's an interesting article that I read in the Wall Street Journal. There's five things that you absolutely positively have to have to be successful in business. Would you like to know what those are?
Yeah.
Okay. And these were in the order of importance. And it kind of reminded me when I saw this piece on the top. Right here. Access to capital was number one. I had a colleague of mine one day, he told me, he said, Steve, if you have a successful business, you'll need more money. Would you agree? Right? Because you've got to fund growth, right? He says, if you have an unsuccessful business, you'll need more money. Would you agree? So I thought to myself, basically you're going to need more money. I mean, because unless you hit your plan perfectly, right, you're going to need more money on either side, right, to either keep it going because it hasn't quite reached takeoff speed yet and you need to put some more money in there, or you're growing like this program that I mentioned earlier in my introduction that talked about winning a $1.2 million contract and not having the cash, essentially, to move that forward. So that was number one. Number two, business acumen. And that's what you're here for. So you understand what's the difference between sales and marketing. What's the difference between finance and accounting? All right, these are small little things. Some of it's the vocabulary, some of it's, you know, the concepts that we try to impart upon people to understand, to move forward. Number three was energy. Here's the thing. I mean, it's something that I never turn it off. I'll give you an example. I mean, I just got back last night from a hunting trip, and so I'm in a hunting blind. Guess what I'm doing? I'm writing blog posts. I'm literally writing blog posts while I'm sitting there. I got nothing else to do, essentially, except I'm sitting there waiting for an antelope to show up in front of my ground blind. So in the meantime, but I'm saying it's always a duty thing. If I sit there and watch TV with my wife, I usually have an iPad on my lap, and something triggers a thought, and I go ahead and you know, write some thoughts, and then eventually I'll flesh that out. Every time I drive down the street, I'm thinking about something. It's something you just don't turn off, okay? So it really is the energy that you have, because it's going to be a 24-hour day function for you. Number four is industry knowledge. Now you're thinking, wait a second, if it's number four on a list of five, wouldn't you think that industry knowledge would be like number one?
No.
You ever heard of the book called The E-Myth by Michael Gerber? Michael Gerber talks about it. He says, basically, you're a technician or you're a manager of the business. And the problem is if you're working in the business, you're not working on the business. So quite frankly, you probably don't even realize this, but if you were to buy a franchise and you had a culinary background and you were trying to buy a restaurant franchise, you wouldn't get it. Right? If you had an automotive background and you were going to get something in the automotive field, you're not going to get it. Because they sell you a system. And they want you to be doing sales. They want you to be doing the marketing for the business along the systems that they've defined. They don't want you to be creative. So imagine if you were a good cook, a culinary, you know, an Emil Lagasse, and you owned a McDonald's, for example. You'd be wanting to change that menu all the time, right? And they don't want that. They want it to be the same everywhere. So that's why industry knowledge is so little. Now, I told you I worked in a fix and flip. I used to actually do spec homes, too. I used to build specs. And I always recount a situation with a general contractor. I was building properties on Chesapeake Bay. And he was the classic example. My dad used to say, if you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And definitely that was him. So the deal is that, quite frankly, every time he would have a situation, he would let go of one of his employees, and he would pick up a hammer and a saw, and he would begin, you know, pounding nails and cutting boards and building that house. And so what would happen is I kept trying to tell him, you need to be hustling the next deal. So when you're out of money, you should be selling more, not trying to save money by letting one of your employees go. Because here's what happened. When the house was done, he didn't have a second job in the pipeline. So what ended up happening was he had to let all his employees go. Then he'd go out there, because he was a good salesman too, he was a nice guy, he'd go out there and he'd sell the next job. But then he would go back and try to get his old employees. Some of them had jobs, you know, already working for somebody else. And now he would bring in maybe one or two of his old crew, and then he'd hire new people. And they, some of them didn't work out so well. And that was the whole reason he ended up having to get rid of them anyway, to go ahead and pick up the hammer and the saw to go do this thing. So he would run through these cycles of feast and famine constantly through this whole cycle. And ultimately got him in some serious trouble, and he lost his contractor's license as a result of that, because he started to use money he shouldn't have to pay for certain things, because he always thought, oh, I'll solve this problem next week. In the meantime, he was borrowing money. I'm going to tell you what, it's a slippery road to kind of get into. None of us go in there with that in mind, but when you're facing this brick wall, like my brother-in-law has always said, he says, you're only as honest as your options, and when your options become quite limited, you start doing things that you normally wouldn't consider doing. And number five is the idea. And so, you know, one of the things I always like to tell people, I say, okay, so here's a ballpoint pen. Right? We all know it's a ballpoint pen. We all know that it replaced the fountain pen. And the fountain pen was quite flawed, would you agree? I mean, it only wrote vertically. If you tipped it sideways, it wouldn't write. If you shook it real hard, ink would drip out of the end. And all those scientists would always wear those plastic pocket protectors because they, you know, and for me, I always had a blue spot in the corner where it would leak. And even with ballpoint pens, the early ballpoint pens. So you would think when this thing came across, this would actually just replace that, because, you know, the ballpoint pen was just so much better than what was existing today. You would agree, right? Do you have any idea how long it took for this to be replaced? Almost 50 years. This fluorescent light bulb right here, right? I grew up in New England. If you've ever been to New England, all the buildings are about this wide. They got glass on both sides. So they have the mills in the middle. And the reason for all that glass, because you had to work during the sunlight. Well, you know, in New England, it gets dark at 4 o'clock. So you can't work anymore. So you would think the invention of fluorescent lights. Now, you couldn't put other things in there. You couldn't put candles in there. I mean, especially woolen mills. I mean, you'd start a fire with all the dust and everything else like that. So even incandescent light bulbs weren't very efficient to go do that. So you would think that with the invention of a fluorescent light bulb, that would have replaced to go off the next day. Do you have any idea how long it took? Almost 80. So my point is, the idea is a rather... it's an idea, okay? It's really about execution. So even if I think about Starbucks, for example, Starbucks didn't invent coffee. Amazon didn't invent how to sell things. Google didn't invent the search engine. They just executed a little bit better than everybody else did. So hence the reason that's in there. But anyway, so these are probably one of the biggest causes of failure. Like I said, lack of capital, in my mind, being number one. Lack of planning, really being able to understand what's out there. Poor management. I mean, the thing is I don't think we carry that business acumen part. And that's kind of where that kind of comes into cash flow. It kind of talks into the capital. The piece, as we talk about that, lack of necessary skills. Again, that talks a little bit to the business acumen. Poor location. If you have a retail location, that's could obviously be a situation, because as being a landlord today, I'm going to tell you what. I mean, that's where the money really comes from, because here's the thing. You know, you look at an airline. I think about that, for example. You take a look at a McDonald's, for example, in an airport. I mean, that line is always out the door. They sell way more hamburgers there, let's say, than they would at this place we have to drive up to. Would you agree? But I can tell you that franchise doesn't make any more than anywhere else, because that landlord, the airport, charges them a rather exorbitant amount of rent. So as a landlord, we always look at the businesses that come in, and whatever profits are in there, we'll extract that, because we know that you're doing the math. And we know that that's a good location for you, and we're going to extract whatever we can to give you maybe just that little bit more than you might get somewhere else. So especially if you're in a retail location, people go, wow, I can't really afford this particular location. Well, the reason is because, well, maybe you're not suited for that particular, your business isn't suited, because they want somebody who has a higher profit margin maybe than you do that can afford that. So that's where poor location, and then the lack of a market. And a lot of things could change the market. But I always like to talk to people about the Edsel. The Edsel was actually a great car. It was revolutionary for the time. The problem was that the Edsel came out, it takes a long time to design a car until it reaches manufacturing. Well, fortunately, we had a depression between the time they started the design and the time they went in there. So by the time the car got there, the market had moved and it had changed. So I just got back here a couple weeks ago from Sturgis, motorcycle rally up there. I go there every year. And it's an interesting thing, because there's another similar story that's related there, and that is, has anybody heard of a guy by the name of Harry Dent? he's an economist, and he looks at people's buying habits. So if you're selling minivans, what's the demographic? Who do you sell that to?
Soccer moms,
right? Exactly. So you can sit there and say, listen, they're 20 years old, so on and so forth. Well, the same thing happens with motorcycles. So if you sell like crotch rockets or something along that line, you know, you have some sales at like the 20s. You don't sell cruisers to 20-year-olds. They don't want to buy that. And so then what happens, almost all of a sudden they have a family, and there's like no sales. I mean, it goes almost to zero. So nobody buys like motorcycles from like age 22 to 47. And at 47, that thing just goes zing right up there. And at 52 or 53, boom, goes back to zero again. I mean, it's the most defined spike, almost zero in front, zero behind. And so if you think about that, why is that? It's because at about 47, your kids have now grown. And you're empty nesters. And while you had the kids there, you really didn't want to, like for me, I didn't want to encourage them to do something rather dangerous or whatever the case is, to go off and do that. And you also now are at the peak of your earning potential. So you go out there and you can afford to buy a $20,000 motorcycle. So you take a look at the baby boom generation. The baby boom generation all went through that. The baby boom generation, the tail end of the baby boom generation is in their 50s now, mid-50s. So here's what happens. You say Harley, if you take a look at Harley stock, for example, or the number of bikes they were selling, you start looking at the leading edge of that baby boom that happened about 15 years ago. All of a sudden, Harley came out of the doldrums and started to sell more motorcycles. And it went all the way. Well, now Harley's kind of on the back end of it. And Harley's kind of losing stuff. They're not meeting the same sales that they had last year. Now, unfortunately, the reason I tell you this is because there's companies like Polaris who kind of came in there. They went in there. They saw what was happening. But in my mind, weren't necessarily the best in terms of foreseeing the future. Obviously, they didn't read Harry Dent's material. But, you know, they reinvented or brought back the Indian line, and they created a Victory line to go ahead and compete directly with Harley-Davidson, which actually took market share from them, quite frankly. But they did it at the end of the cycle. So, you know, While they're digging in right now, the only survival that they have right now, quite frankly, is to dig into Harley's, you know, market share or Honda's market share or somebody like that, because the market itself is shrinking because the baby boomers are beyond that type of thing, or they have to come out with new bikes. And so when I was up there in Sturgis, I noticed what they were doing. They're back on the 20-something stage. They're selling these electric bikes and these super crotch rocket type versions of it because there's another wave that they call them the boomerang generation that's now in that window there that's buying that. So the millennials. Okay, so that's where the lack of market kind of comes from. So some of it can be predicted as you kind of go through there.
Thank you for listening to How to Turn My Hobby into a Full-Fledged Business. To learn more about Steve Imke, or to learn more about what it takes to own and operate a small business, please visit stevebizblog.com. That's stevebizblog.com. Or look for Steve's many books on various aspects of small business ownership at amazon.com or at stevebizblog.com.